Okay, we've gone from a general overview of mineral physics to a discussion of phase equilibria, including the thermodynamic foundations of that, and then to some considerations of the physical properties of mineral phases, and we'll continue with that today. And then starting with the next lecture, I believe is on Tuesday, we'll look at some challenges sort of at the frontiers of mineral physics. We'll start looking at that with ab initio theory on Tuesday, and then Abby will talk about transport properties and inelasticity after that, and we'll wrap it up with a sort of overview lecture on the state of knowledge, the current state of knowledge in mineral physics. Okay, so today I'll talk about lattice dynamics, and I want to motivate this a bit because it does get into the physics of minerals to a degree that perhaps many of you haven't seen before, and I want to show you first why it's important for mineral physicists certainly, but perhaps also for geophysicists to have some feeling for what the microscopic basis for material properties are and why it's important to have such a basis, such a foundation, at least in broad outline. So here's one way to think of it. Focus on one particular property, the thermal expansion. This is what's driving mantle convection, right? If we didn't have thermal expansion, we wouldn't have convection. So it's a very important property, and basically the idea is that as temperature changes at constant pressure, the density changes, all right? And that's what causes this plume to form in the first place, and that's what causes it to rise. It has become less dense than its surroundings by virtue of being hotter. Well, thermodynamics, as I talked about in my lectures, is a really powerful theory, and it tells you lots of things. And one of the things it would tell you in this case is that it would allow you to relate the changes in density that have resulted from the change in temperature to changes in other physical properties. That change in density will be connected to changes in entropy, to heat capacity, to bulk modulus, to all kinds of other, to, in fact, in general, all other thermodynamic properties, and it tells you the relationships among all those changes. What thermodynamics cannot tell you, however, is the magnitude of the thermal expansivity. It can't even tell you the sign of the thermal expansivity, not by itself, all right? You have to supplement the theory of thermodynamics with some particular knowledge about the material that you're looking at, all right? Thermal expansivity can be negative, it can be zero. It would be nice for us as geophysicists to have some fundamental understanding that in the deep interior, at the high temperatures that we have, thermal expansivity does tend to be positive. So we'd like to have an understanding of that. Why is alpha generally positive? And we'd also like to have a way of predicting or at least rationalizing how thermal expansivity changes the pressure and temperature and composition. Now we can measure these things in the laboratory. We can measure thermal expansivity versus pressure, temperature, and composition. But the Earth is a very large place, and the ranges of all those variables are very large. And it's very unlikely that we'll ever have experimental measurements over the entire relevant range. So, in order to understand things a little more deeply, we need to go from the macroscopic, as illustrated by this geodynamic model here, we have to zoom in about a factor of 10 to the 23rd into that plume there, so that we can look at the atoms. And it's only at that level that we can really understand why thermal expansivity is usually positive and how it changes the pressure, temperature, and composition. This also, in terms of the theory behind it, we're going from thermodynamics, which tells us lots of stuff, but not the particular values, doesn't allow us to predict that by itself, to something called statistical mechanics, which is the foundation of everything I'll talk about today. And it's a very particular application. It's a tiny little piece of statistical mechanics that is particularly relevant to the Earth's mantle. Okay, one way to start thinking about the microscopic view of materials is to start thinking about interatomic forces. Okay, you take two atoms and there's some force acting between them. There's an attractive part of that force. Perhaps the two atoms have opposite charges, and so that attractive force might be coulombic. There's also a repulsive force. As they get closer and closer together and their electron clouds overlap, they'll tend to repel each other. At some intermediate distance is a happy medium where the potential energy has some minimum value. And so that aspect of the potential energy versus distance curve tells you something about interatomic spacings and therefore volumes and densities of materials. The curvature also tells us something important. The curvature at the minimum here you can show is related to the bulk modulus. We saw a couple lectures ago how the second volume derivative of a thermodynamic potential can give you the bulk modulus. Well, here we're talking about a second derivative with respect to distance, which is basically the same thing, except for a 1^3 exponent. So the curvature is related to the bulk modulus. The thermal expansivity is a little trickier. We have to go beyond just the second derivative of the potential here. We have to consider the third order derivative. We have to go beyond the harmonic properties of that potential well, in other words, in order to understand the thermal expansivity. Now, there are two ways of thinking about that, about how the thermal expansivity is related to the interatomic potential here. The first way is the one that's commonly illustrated in Turcotte and Schubert and others, and it's really strictly applicable only to molecules. And in the context of solids, it's a little misleading. But let me show you this first, because it is kind of neat. All right. So say you have your two atoms and you increase the temperature. These atoms are going to vibrate, the bond length is going to change, and the higher the temperature, the greater the variation in bond length is. So you can think of the molecule as occupying some high position in this well here, sort of vibrate the distance varying back and forth from one sort of turning point of this well to the other. And as you get to higher and higher temperatures, the molecule will occupy a higher and higher position in this well. Now, because of the asymmetry of this well, if you take the average bond distance of this molecule, the average bond distance is going to move outwards because of the asymmetry, and so the bond is going to thermally expand. All right? That's a fine way of looking at it for molecules. For solids, we'll see that that doesn't really work. The basic reason for that is that if you think about the one, if you now fix one atom and let the other move like this, and it's thermally expanding the bond and so on, in a solid, there's a third atom over here, all right? So the atom that's vibrating isn't really sensing this asymmetry. It's really vibrating around in a symmetric potential well. And so the question is, how do you get thermal expansivity in a solid where this asymmetry doesn't arise so obviously? And we'll see how that goes. It turns out that the thermal expansivity in a solid arises from the fact that the frequencies depend on compression. As you compress the solid, the vibrational frequencies get faster and faster, and that's what gives you thermal expansivity. Okay, let's look at the dynamics of this situation. So we've thought about the forces interacting acting between atoms, and from those forces, of course, we can derive dynamics. And we'll look first at a very simple crystal, a one-dimensional crystal made of one kind of atom, and then we'll generalize, first to three dimensions, and then to a crystal that contains two different kinds of atoms. And then I'll show you what real crystals look like, which won't be that different from our final generalization. And as I go through this, I'll try and make contact as much as possible to the macroscopic world. Okay, so we'll be looking at atoms and how atoms are interacting with each other, but we'll see at several points how the dynamics relate directly back to even seismologically observable properties. Okay, so we have a chain of atoms here. Let's label them n and n plus 1 and n plus 2 and n minus 1 and n minus 2, et cetera, et cetera. And let's say that they, without any temperature, okay, let's say that they occupy regular positions on a regular lattice with some spacing A to it. And now let's consider the dynamics. Let's think about what happens if we move one of these atoms a little bit. Okay, if we move one of these atoms, there will be a net force acting on it. This guy is going to tend to push it back to its original site. This guy is going to tend to attract it back to its original site. All right, so there will be a force. We can write the potential, the contribution to the potential energy of the crystal from that atom that's moving in terms of some static reference potential energy, plus a term that goes like the square of the distance. This is basically Hooke's law, simple harmonic oscillator. Okay, as this guy moves, the potential energy increases like the square of the displacement. We can also get a force which goes linearly in the displacement, and the constant of proportionality here is what's known as a force constant, and it's just the second derivative of the potential with respect to displacement of that particle. Okay, so we know the force, we can write down the equation of motion. Here's m, here's a, here's f, okay? F equals ma, these are the equations of motion for this one particular atom, u sub n, all right? And the forces acting on it are going to come from, in general, all the other atoms in the lattice, and that's why we have the sum over all the other atoms in the lattice here, times the force constant between our primary atom and all the other atoms. We'll try solutions like this, and aspects of the solution that will be important later are, here's the frequency, omega, and here is something called the wave vector, which is 2 pi over the wavelength of the vibrational modes that we're going to look at in a minute, okay? So in a minute we're going to make plots of frequency versus wave vector. Frequency, you know about, wave vector, might be a little more difficult to think about initially. It's 2 pi over the wavelength of the vibrational mode. So this is a differential equation. You can solve it. Here's the solution. Omega ends up going like the sine of the wave vector. Okay? And now we're going to look at this solution. Here's the, and we specialize to the case of just nearest neighbor interactions here. Here's the force constant. Okay, this is what describes the magnitude of the forces, and it also, therefore, describes the magnitude of the frequencies. Also appearing in here is the mass of the particle. So the vibrational frequency depends on the interatomic force, the strength of the interatomic force, if you like, K, and the mass of the atom, M. Before I go on, let's just think about this a little bit more. We can turn this around. I'll show you in a minute that we can measure in the laboratory these vibrational frequencies. And this is very important because we can then use this relationship and the measured vibrational frequency to tell something about the interatomic forces. So it's a way of probing interatomic forces in the laboratory. And I'll show you some examples of that in a minute because we generally know what the mass is. Okay, so here's what the solution looks like. It went like sine of the wave vector, so it's going to be some periodic thing. It went like the absolute value of the sine, so we're not going to have both positive and negative values. They're all going to be positive, and we'll get this sort of loopy thing like this. So we have frequency versus wave vector here, and the periodicity of the solution reflects and is demanded by the periodicity of the lattice that we started out with. Okay, so what we have are frequencies that are zero at zero wave vector, and then as we go to higher and higher wave vector, that is shorter and shorter wavelength of the vibrational mode, I'll show you our cartoon in a second, as we increase the wave vector, the frequency of the vibration increases until it reaches a maximum value. Now, once you've covered this part of the curve, you've basically included all the information that's in the solution, and so generally what's done is to not represent the complete solution like this, but just to consider a little piece of it like this that does contain all the information, all the variation of frequency with wave vectors contained in there, modulo periodicities. So we just look at this one piece, and this one piece gets a special name. It's called the first Brillouin zone, after the guy that first thought of it. And we'll continue to think about this first Brillouin zone, and it'll be particularly important for understanding how we generalize to a polyatomic lattice. That'll come in a little bit. Okay. Let's look at what I'm going to do now is I'm going to illustrate two vibrational modes of our one-dimensional lattice. One of these vibrational modes will be at the Brillouin zone edge here, all right, where the frequency is maximum. And the other vibrational mode will be very close to the Brillouin zone center, where the frequency is very small. Here's what they look like. Okay, so here's our one-dimensional lattice. The arrows indicate the mode of vibration in the first case at the Brillouin zone edge. And at the Brillouin zone edge, the wave vector takes on its maximum value. Therefore, the wavelength takes on its minimum value, which is equal to twice the lattice spacing. Okay, so the periodicity of the pattern of vibration is twice the lattice constant. So every two atoms are vibrating in the same way. Every second atom vibrates in the same way. All right. So what we have are atoms vibrating. Another way of thinking about it is that we have atoms vibrating against each other in pairs here, right? And this is going to be a high-frequency mode of vibration. You're probing the interatomic forces very directly, changing the bond length, every bond length, to first order in this vibrational mode. All right, so that's going to have high frequency. The other vibrational mode, very near the Brillouin zone center, as the wave vector approaches zero, the wavelength of the vibrational mode is going to approach infinity. All right, so now we're talking about a very long wavelength modulation of the vibrations of the atoms. Okay, so all the atoms over here for a very long way are moving away from the center, if you like, and all the atoms over here for a very long way are moving in the opposite direction. And so we have sort of a in the limit, as the wavelength goes to infinity, we'll have a breathing of the entire crystal out and in. Okay, that's going to be one of our vibrational modes as the wave vector goes to zero. Now, that frequency is going to be very low, and one way to think of that is it takes a lot of energy to move the entire crystal in unison all the way out and all the way in again. Okay, very different from changing individual bond lengths one at a time. So this frequency is going to be very low. Okay, and this explains what's called the dispersion of the phonon spectrum, that is the dependence of the frequency on the wave vector. Low at the Brillouin zone center where k is zero, high at the Brillouin zone edge where k takes on its maximum value. Okay, now let's generalize to three dimensions. And first I'm going to show you a couple of pictures and of what the vibrational modes might look like in three dimensions. We're going to generalize these. We're going to focus actually on the long wavelength modes. Okay, so we want to look at what one of these long wavelength modes looks like in three dimensions, and I'm going to ask you to relate it to a geophysically relevant property. Yes?
So, phonon in this context is discrete unit of energy?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, and we think about the a phonon then corresponds to a particular mode of vibration, such as those that I showed you here. There's also a certain population associated with it. You can think of a particular vibrational mode being populated with a certain number of phonons, and we'll come back to that in a minute. That's important for understanding the heat capacity and things like that. Okay, so now here's a three-dimensional crystal. It doesn't look that different from the one-dimensional crystal. Okay, what we have are, I've extended it out in this direction, and you also have to imagine that there are planes of atoms running in and out this direction. And what we have here is a long wavelength mode. We have expansion of the entire lattice over here, and then over here we have compression, and then expansion, and then compression, and then expansion, and then compression. So what does that look like? What does that remind you of? A P wave. And that's exactly what it is. This is a P wave on the microscopic scale. So there's a direct connection between lattice dynamics as you approach the Brillouin zone center and seismology, or more particularly seismic wave velocities. This is this mode of vibration is a P wave, and in the limit that the wavelength goes to infinity, you have the P wave velocity. Here's another mode of vibration, another long wavelength mode of vibration. In three dimensions, we're going to have three modes of vibration for each wave vector, all right? And in this case, we have some stuff going down here, and then up here, and then down here, and then up here. And what would that correspond to? An S wave. And you could also think about these guys going into the board, these guys coming out, these guys going in, these guys coming out, which is another S wave, all right? So, for each wave vector, there's going to be a vibrational mode that corresponds to a P wave, and two others that correspond to S waves. Just to look at the connection a little more precisely, we have our dispersion relation here, the one that we had on the board before, and the one that we looked at graphically, the relationship between frequency and wave vector. As the wave vector goes to zero, the sign, we can replace the sign just with its argument, like this, and we can look at either the ratio of frequency to wave vector or the derivative of one with respect to the other. In either case, we'll get something that goes like the lattice spacing times the force constant over the mass square root, and that is the acoustic velocity. So we can relate the seismic wave velocity directly to the lattice spacing, the interatomic force, and the mass of the atoms. As I mentioned, in three dimensions, now for each wave vector, whereas in the one-dimensional case we just had one of these curves, in the three-dimensional case we have three of them, corresponding to different modes of vibration. The one mode corresponding to the P wave, where the atoms move against each other, and the other two corresponding to shear motions. Okay, so we can think about the wave vector and also the polarization vector that describes the pattern of atomic motions for that particular vibrational mode. Okay, because of the connection to elastic wave velocities, these branches that I've drawn here, which go to zero at the Brillouin zone center, are referred to as acoustic modes, and now we're going to see the other kind of mode, which occur only in polyatomic crystals. Okay. So here's a polyatomic lattice. What I've done is to color every other atom differently, corresponding to a different kind of atom. So now, instead of just a lattice of iron atoms, say, we have a lattice of alternating iron, oxygen, if you like. Okay. The unit cell now is doubled in size because we have two different kinds of atoms. The size of the Brillouin zone, which goes like 2 pi over the lattice spacing, now must be halved. It must be shrunk by half. Okay? So we have our original Brillouin zone here and our original dispersion curve. Okay, that's before the coloring operation that I did up here. But now, after the coloring operation, the lattice spacing is doubled. And so the Brillouin zone is halved. It's cut in half. Here's the new Brillouin zone boundary here. And what we end up having to do is to fold this part of the dispersion curve back on itself so that it intersects zero wave vector at finite frequency. Now, if all I did was color, I mean, there's no magic here. I mean, there has to be physics in it, too. If all I did was to color the different atoms, we could think about the phonon dispersion curve in this way, but in reality, what we would find is that the intensity of this mode is zero at the origin. For the intensity to be non-zero, we really do have to make the colors correspond to different kinds of atoms. Okay, the interesting thing about this, so the unique thing about polyatomic lattices as opposed to monatomic lattices is that we do now have a vibrational mode that has a finite frequency at zero wave vector, and that's something we didn't have in the monatomic case. This is a new branch of our phonon dispersion curve. It's called the optic branch, and the reason it's called that is that obviously there's some connection with light. Well, if we think about light, and we think about the wavelength of light on the atomic scale is enormous. It's several hundred nanometers, whereas a typical interatomic spacing is a tenth of a nanometer. So we can think, if we think about the wave vector that corresponds to the wavelength of light, we're talking about wave vectors that are almost at the origin, all right? The wavelength of light is so huge, it's so enormous, that we're almost at the Brillouin zone center if we're probing our sample with especially visible light, all right? And so this mode here is observable by optical means, by using light, and that's why it's called the optic branch. Okay. I'll get to thermodynamic properties in a minute. We'll use these some of these concepts to compute some of the thermodynamic quantities that we've been talking about, including the thermal expansivity. But first, let me say a little bit more about vibrational modes in crystals. One thing that we will need later on is that the total number of modes is 3 times the number of atoms in the crystal. And the interesting thing about this is that we'll see a movie actually in a minute too. The interesting thing about this is that these 3N vibrational modes are organized into these branches, okay? Even in complex crystals. I mean, here's quartz. Quartz is not a simple crystal by any means. And the 3N vibrational modes are organized into these various branches. And you can predict just how many branches there will be. And it depends on the number of atoms in the unit cell. Quartz has, let's see, it has 9 atoms in the unit cell, so we should find 27 branches on this figure. 3 of them are acoustic. Here are the 3 acoustic branches going to 0 at the Brillouin zone center. The other 24 are optic branches, observable by some kind of optical spectroscopy. And you see that the frequency changes with wave vector. Here's the Brillouin zone center. Here's the Brillouin zone edge, and you can see the acoustic modes with this initially linear dependence sort of curving over.
Mark?
Yes?
What's the difference between a branch and a node?
Right. A branch refers to one of these lines. This line is composed of many modes, many vibrational modes, all with different wavelengths of atomic displacements. So each of these branches actually corresponds to a very large number of individual modes. And for an atom with a finite number of atoms, each of these branches is actually a discrete set of points, all right? Generally, there's so many atoms that you can't tell the difference between the discrete set of points and a continuous line. For an infinite crystal, yeah.
Oh, so N is just the number.
N is the total number of atoms in your crystal. So something on the order of 10 to the 23rd, yeah. So an enormous number of modes, and initially it seems like an impossible problem. How are you going to enumerate 10 to the 23rd vibrational modes? It's impossible, right? But the fact is that they're organized in this special way. And the organization comes from the fact that crystals have translational symmetry, right? And the unit cell tends to be very small, and 9 atoms in the case of quartz, okay? A quartz crystal of 10 to the 23rd atoms, but the unit cell only has 9 atoms. And that's what gives you the organization. You can measure these things. This is the result of actually a combined measurement and theoretical calculation. But the basic idea is that you can measure these things. The full phonon spectrum, as we've been looking at by inelastic neutron diffraction, which hasn't been applied that much at high pressure, but I think in the coming years it will be, and that's going to be very important. The zone center vibrational modes, the ones that intersect the k equals zero axis here, or nearly do so, have played a very important role in geophysics. And one of the suggested readings by Sue Kiefer goes through some of the connections there. And we're going to look at some of the connections further. And these are much easier to measure. And this is an example from a high-pressure hydrosilicate, where each of these peaks here corresponds to one of these branches intersecting k equals zero. And every one of those modes, you can relate to a particular mode of vibration You can relate to the interatomic forces, to the masses involved. So for example, these guys up here are all due to stretching of the SiO bond, whereas these lower frequency ones down here are due to movements of the magnesium in a much larger coordination environment. Yes? Yes, yes, the same number of modes of vibration for every branch. That's right.
Mm-hmm. In the previous simple example where you just doubled the lattice spacing and you folded over the thing, there was a continuity between the right hand side and the right, when you go to the right and kind of reflect off the boundary to come to the left.
Yes.
In some of these, it's not apparent that they're related, but I was just wondering.
Ah, yes. Good point, good point, good point. Okay, so. God, I always do that. Okay. Let's see. Whoa, going the wrong way. Okay, here we go. So, right. So, when I folded the Brillouin zone over, I left this branch completely continuous, right? Whereas in the quartz example I showed you, you notice that there is actually a gap here, that you don't get a continuity between the optic branch and the acoustic branch in general. There's a gap. And what that gap is caused by are the physical differences between the atoms. If you make the red and the blue atoms differ physically only in their mass, for example, you can show that the size of the gap that's introduced is related to the ratio of the masses. Okay, now I do want to leave this. This is kind of fun, and I just wanted to give you a feeling for what these vibrational modes look like in an interesting crystal. And to give you a sense that they really exist. I mean, this is a theoretical prediction, of course, but all the experimental measurements we make on crystals are understood on the basis of a picture in our heads that looks much like this. So this is MgSO3 perovskite. We have SiO6 octahedra in blue. We have magnesium atoms in yellow here. And this is at a temperature of 3,000 degrees, I think, and some lower mantle pressure. I can't remember exactly which. And what we're doing is we're solving Newton's equations of motion, much like I outlined for the one-dimensional lattice. Now we generalize it to three dimensions to an interesting crystal structure. We've worked extremely hard to calculate just what the interatomic forces are. That's where almost all the work goes into calculating what those forces are. That's done with Schrodinger's equation. I'll get to that Tuesday. But some of the things you can see in here are different frequencies of vibration. So if you look at the octahedra here, they're deforming and they're also changing shape. They're changing shape and size. The change in size will have the highest frequency of vibration, the change in shape somewhat lower frequency. The lowest frequencies of all will be these magnesium atoms sort of swimming around back and forth very lazily in a very large coordination environment. So it's partly because the magnesium-oxygen bond is weaker than the silicon-oxygen bond, partly because the bond lengths are just really long that the magnesium atoms go so slowly. Yeah. Yeah, there in general there won't be a repeat time, or if there is it'll be extremely long. Yeah. And the apparently random vibrations here are the result of the sum of all those phonon modes that we looked at before. You could calculate what the various branches of the phonon dispersion curves for perovskite were and add them all up. Of course, they all have different phase shifts, and so what you see in a movie here ends up looking random. But if you zoomed in and just plotted, you know, SiO bond length versus time or something, you would see something much more regular. Yes?
Those dispersion curves give the position, what the modes are. How do you calculate the intensity of each mode? How much?
Yeah, the intensity, well, depends on what you mean by intensity. If you mean by experimentally the intensity that you would measure in a laboratory experiment, the amplitude of the mode, you mean?
Like, for example, in this picture, I would my internal picture for the cross-site structure is that most of the vibrations would take place with the individual units rotating with respect to each other. But my stock picture had a lot more shape change with them all together than.
Yeah. Yeah, the amplitude will depend on the amount of thermal energy you have available, so the temperature, and it'll also depend on the frequency. And if the frequency is low and the potential well is very broad, the amplitude may be very large. And that's why the magnesiums have this large amplitude. Now, the sort of floppy modes of octahedral rotation, you might also expect to have rather large amplitude. I think what's going on is that octahedral rotations are coupled. You can't rotate one octahedron without rotating the others, whereas you can move one magnesium without moving the others. And so I think that's either it's an optical illusion that the amplitudes look like they're smaller, or it's a real effect of having to couple these rotations to one another. Okay, and if you look very carefully, there's an extremely low frequency mode, which, and this actually gets back, Abby, to your question. So the lowest frequency mode of all, now that I think of it, is an octahedral rotation mode. And if we go back to the starting point, okay, so if you look at how the octahedra are aligned here, these guys on the bottom are sort of tilted this way a little bit, and the ones on top are tilted in a little bit like that. And they're aligned between the front plane of octahedra and the back plane of octahedra, right? Now, if we go back to the beginning, that pattern is different, okay? Now, the front plane of octahedra are rotated in a different sense from the back plane of octahedra. And as we go through the movie one more time, what you'll see is the back plane line up with the front plane with this extremely low frequency mode of vibration. So now they're pretty much aligned. And if we ran the movie further forward in time, we would see them rotate back to the original configuration. And originally we thought this was a phase transformation, and we were very excited, to a different form of perovskite. But I think it turns out we just didn't run the movie long enough. So,
could you get really low frequency sharing structures?
In principle, out of one of these molecular dynamic simulations, you can obtain a phase transformation that will correspond to a systematically different rotation of the octahedra. That could, in principle, come out. It didn't come out of these particular calculations, probably because perovskite doesn't really do that in the mantle. But if we looked at another material, and these types of methods have been used to predict phase transformations. Okay. Oh, back to.
Ah.
No. Just solve Newton's equations of motion. You calculate the forces quantum mechanically. You know what the masses are. You can calculate the accelerations, and that's it. No. Because the forces are calculated for every atom separately at every time step from the full quantum mechanics. So at every snapshot of that movie, we're solving the Schrodinger's equation completely. So yes, the interatomic forces do change as you go through the phase transformation. In fact, they change as you go through one vibrational mode. And the code captures all that because it's solving the whole quantum mechanics every time step.
So every time you're computing the force, forces at a critical location due to all the other elements present.
Yes.
And that's each one of the independent Schrodinger equation solution for each, or is it?
No, the Schrodinger's equation is solved for the periodic infinite crystal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then from that, we can compute the forces on each individual atom. Okay, let's see. Okay. So let's make our way back towards the first slide of this presentation, back towards thermal expansivity, and there will be a couple of steps along the way, and we'll end up looking at thermal expansivity from a slightly different point of view. But we'll see how it's related to the vibrations. So let's first look at the internal energy. All right, the internal energy, the thermal part of the internal energy, will be just a sum of the energies of all these vibrational modes. Okay, so we've counted all these modes, we've looked at patterns among them, and we can calculate the energy of each vibrational mode. You add them all up and you get the vibrational contribution to the internal energy. The energy of each mode depends on its frequency, and it also depends on its population. And one way of thinking about that is to look at the solution for just a single simple harmonic oscillator. Here's the potential well that describes the simple harmonic oscillator. We have energy versus displacement, and the quantum mechanical solution involves these discrete energy levels, okay, which are spaced like this in units of the vibrational frequency. Okay, so n equals 0, 1, 2, and so on. This one will be populated even at zero temperature, and as you increase the temperature, it's going to take some finite amount of temperature for the system to jump up into this next discrete energy level, and this is the basis of the heat capacity going to zero, which confused people for a very long time, and which I'll get to in a second. Okay, the population of each mode, basically the average n number that each vibrational mode has, will depend then on the temperature. The higher the temperature, the more you can excite these higher lying states. It'll also depend on the frequency, because the frequency is controlling the spacing between these states. So actually it ends up depending on a ratio between frequency and temperature. So the vibrational contribution to the internal energy, there is a 0 point contribution from all the vibrational modes sitting in that n equals zero state, which is populated even at zero temperature. And then this other temperature dependent part, which again depends on the frequencies of the vibrational energy here and the population of the modes here. Now, if you went through all the statistical mechanics and derived the partition function and all that, you could calculate what this average population number is. And it turns out to be this. And what I'll show you is that after the fact, if the population looks like that, you get something that's sensible. Okay, so if we plug this in here, the vibrational energy ends up looking like this. And what we can do now is we can take the high temperature limit of the vibrational energy. All right? What happens as the temperature becomes very, very large compared to the frequency? What happens is that the argument becomes small. We can replace the exponential with 1 plus the argument. The 1 and the minus 1 subtract out. We're left with the argument itself. So the denominator gets replaced by just the argument. And what we end up being left with then is just kT, because the h bar omega divides out top and bottom. So the high temperature limit of the internal energy just looks like this. And if we take the temperature derivative of that, we get the heat capacity, which is just 3 times the number of atoms times Boltzmann's constant. And this is the famous Dulong-Petit result. Or re-expressing it in terms of the chemist's unit. Physicists count atoms and chemists count moles. It ends up being the same thing. Mole is just like a dozen, except larger. So back to chemistry units here, the heat capacity is just 3 times the gas constant, which is 8.3 joules per mole Kelvin. And so multiply that by 3, you get about 25. So here's the Dulong-Petit limit. Okay. And what is also shown here are measurements of the heat capacity of forsterite. And the measurements are in dots here. And the line is a very simple model of the heat capacity where I've replaced all the vibrational frequencies with a single average vibrational frequency. Okay, almost a trivial approximation. It's remarkable how well it works. Anyway, that's the line. And you can see that the heat capacity goes to zero, basically because it takes some finite amount of temperature in order to populate that first higher discrete level significantly. As you go to high temperature, the heat capacity nearly approaches this constant Dulong-Petit value of 3R. Doesn't quite approach it, and there's a very good reason for that. What's measured is the heat capacity constant pressure, and that differs from the heat capacity constant volume, right? So in geophysics, we often think of the heat capacity as being a constant at high temperature, but we have to remember that it isn't quite because of the difference between Cp and Cv. The difference is probably not significant, taking into account all the other uncertainties in, say, a thermal history calculation, but it's worth keeping in mind. Okay, thermal pressure. So now we're getting closer to thermal expansivity. We'll get there on the next slide. We'll think of it in terms of thermal pressure instead of thermal expansivity. And I'll relate these two points of view in the next graph. All right? So just hang on for a minute, and then we'll get to thermal expansivity in the next one. The pressure is the volume derivative of the Helmholtz free energy with a minus sign. And so we need to know what the Helmholtz free energy is, and there it is. And it looks like it has a lot of similarities with the expression we had for the internal energy. We've got ratios of frequencies to temperatures. We've got a sum over all 3N vibrational modes. We've got a KT. We've got lots of similarities. There are some differences, too, because the Helmholtz free energy and the internal energy are different things. And you can check that this agrees with the internal energy by using the Legendre transformations that I showed you a couple lectures ago. All right, so we need to take the volume derivative of this. What's going to depend on volume in here? Well, the temperature doesn't, not a constant temperature. K doesn't, H doesn't. The only thing that depends on volume is the frequency. All right, so if the frequencies depend on volume, and they do, it's an experimental observation, there are very good fundamental reasons for that, then you get a finite thermal pressure. And it's this Grünheisen parameter, gamma, that describes the volume dependence of the frequencies, right? The Grünheisen parameter ends up being defined as the logarithmic volume derivative of the frequencies with a minus sign out front. The minus sign is there because frequencies increase with compression, okay? So frequency and volume move in opposite directions. As you decrease the volume, the frequencies increase. And this is actually very important. So if we look at a sort of simple harmonic oscillator representation of the potential energy of a vibrational mode at low pressure in red and higher pressure in blue, what happens as you compress the lattice and the atoms get closer and closer together is that the potential energy curve also gets sort of squished together, right? The same amount of displacement costs a lot more energy at high pressure than it does at low pressure because the atoms are closer together. All right? So as you compress, the vibrational frequencies increase, the vibrational energy increases, and that's what gives you the thermal pressure. And it's this Grünheisen parameter that relates this compression-dependent change in the vibrational energy to the thermal pressure. That thermal pressure is what gives you thermal expansivity. And let's look at it graphically and with a few simple equations over there. What we have here is an equation of state, pressure versus density of MgSO3 perovskite. I calculated this, but other people would get pretty much the same picture. And what I've done is to calculate the equation of state along a cold adiabat here, say room temperature, potential temperature, and a hotter adiabat here. I forget what I use, maybe 1000K or 1600K, I don't know, doesn't matter. Okay, now on this plot of the sort of cold and the hot equation of state, we see thermal expansion, all right? Our familiar thermal expansion, thermal expansivity, as we go from cold to hot, the density decreases. Okay, now from the theoretical point of view, it turns out to be much more convenient and much more useful to think about thermal expansivity in sort of the orthogonal way. Because in theory, you generally want to fix the geometry first, and because the geometry changes with pressure, you generally want to think about things changing at constant density. Okay, so instead of moving this way, thermal expansion, we're going to move this way, constant density. And if we look at constant density, the hot adiabat has a higher pressure than the cold adiabat, right? There's a difference in pressure there, which of course is intimately related to the difference in density, constant pressure. The two are connected to each other. And it's this difference in pressure here that I've been calling the thermal pressure. That thermal pressure has about this magnitude at mantle temperatures, very simple. Gamma tends to be about 1, plus or minus 1. Rho is the density, 3, I guess you know what that is. N is the number of atoms in the formula unit, R is the gas constant, T is the temperature. So that's the thermal pressure to a very good approximation at mantle conditions. And what we can also look at is, so that is a way of thinking about the equation of state and about thermal expansion. The fact that the thermal pressure is positive means that the thermal expansivity is positive. We can extract a bit more from this graph here, and what we can do is we can look at the change in slope of the curve as we increase the temperature, as we go from the cold adiabat to the hot adiabat. And you notice that the slope does change, and I've made a change in the way that it does for almost all materials. It changes in such a way the cold and hot adiabats tend to converge as you go up in pressure. Thermal effects tend to get squeezed out. That's one way of thinking about it. And so what's happening is that the slope is actually decreasing as we go from the cold adiabat to the hot adiabat. Now what's that slope related to? That slope is just the bulk sound velocity, right? Vp squared minus 4/3 Vs squared. So we have contact with another geophysically relevant quantity. And so this also tells us how the bulk sound velocity changes with temperature. It tends to decrease with increasing temperature. No big surprise there. But this would allow us to rationalize that dependence and also to estimate the magnitude of that dependence. Because we're also interested in the bulk sound velocity, we tend to introduce one more term. The bulk sound velocity goes like the density dependence of this guy, all right? So we need to take a density derivative of this, and so we end up having to take a density derivative of the Grüneisen parameter. And so the temperature dependence of the bulk sound velocity turns out to be related to this guy, which is giving you the next higher order term in the frequency versus density dependence. And it's just called Q, it doesn't have a different name. And the best way to detect this guy is to actually measure the bulk sound velocity versus temperature at low pressures. And it's important, getting this guy right is very important for understanding lateral variations in seismic wave velocities, especially at great depth. Yes?
Is there a reason why this Q versus
It's convenient. I mean, it ends up being dimensionless that way. The equations that you would write for the temperature dependence of the bulk modulus, for example, turn out to be neater if you define Q this way. So that's why. No, but I could later if you want. Shear is tougher. Shear is a lot tougher. It's a lot more complicated. And let's see. All the things that I've told, one way to think about that is that all the things that I've told you about just depend on changes in isotropic properties. Isotropic changes in pressure, isotropic changes in volume, and so on. In order to understand shear properties, you have to generalize the volume to the strain tensor, the pressure to the stress tensor, and look at derivatives of all that. You end up having to generalize other things as well. The Grünheisen parameter ends up becoming a tensor. What you have to examine is how the vibrational frequencies change as you compress the crystal in one direction versus another or with shear. So you have to include all that. And that can certainly be done. And various people have done that, going back to Jeff Davies, interestingly enough, and even people before that. And I can show that later if people are interested.
How much does the thermal expansivity change throughout the lower mantle? As I hear occasionally Don Anderson saying that thermal expansivity is effectively zero, it's extremely small, so therefore you don't have much of a convection in the lower mantle.
Yeah. I think it could change by an order of magnitude over the depth of the mantle. Now, an order of magnitude change doesn't make it go to zero at the bottom of the mantle. And I guess I think his statements about that are exaggerated in the sense that the other parameters that go into the Rayleigh number are, at this point, probably much more uncertain than the thermal expansivity. We have a pretty good idea of what it does and how it depends on pressure. But the others are both more uncertain and could change with pressure a lot more. The viscosity could change with pressure a lot more. The thermal diffusivity could change with pressure a lot more. And we have almost no idea from the mineral physics perspective about what those pressure dependencies might be. You could appeal to geophysical modeling and observations of the modeling of the geoid and so on. But from the mineral physics perspective, the data are not quite absent, but nearly so. So yeah, thermal expansivity decreases with pressure, and that's for sure. But there are other things you need to worry about. So back to this. So we have a way of understanding where the thermal expansivity comes from. It doesn't depend so much on the asymmetry of this potential well as it does with how this well gets sharper and sharper as you increase the pressure. Okay. So a different point of view, one that's different from the usual textbooks like Turcotte and Schubert, but I think one that's actually applicable to solids. And where we're going next then is in part a further exploration of the sort of microscopic picture of Earth materials to ab initio calculations and first principles theory on Tuesday, where we'll look at how you might predict what a curve like this would look like. Where do the interatomic forces come from? Experiments can give you some information from the vibrational frequencies. You'd like to be able to calculate it theoretically also, or at least to have a theory available. And that we'll look at on Tuesday. And then after that, Abby will look at transport properties and inelasticity. And that has to do with in part with doing much more violent things to the crystal lattice. All that I've talked about here, all the lattice vibrations, all that stuff, I didn't break any bonds. All the bonds remained intact, and we were just looking at relatively gentle modifications of the crystal structure about its normal state. In many transport properties that are important, bond breaking becomes very important, especially in viscosity and inelasticity. And that complicates the theoretical picture tremendously. So that'll be coming up. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Started with the harmonic potential well and got thermal expansion out of it.
Right.
Can you start with the molecule, come out the fraction, get thermal expansion?
No. No, a harmonic molecule won't thermally expand, and the crystal expands because of this compression dependence of the vibrational frequencies through the Gruen-Eisen parameter. Another way to think of it is that as you go up in pressure, you're probing this repulsive part of the potential well, and you're probing, if you think of a Taylor series expansion of this potential well, you're probing higher order terms of the Taylor series expansion. So in a way, thermal expansion in solids also comes from anharmonicity, or the beyond harmonic part of the potential well, because you start probing these higher energies. So thermal expansion in solids and the shape of this well are not disconnected from each other, but it's misleading to just look at this well and say, aha, that's where thermal expansion of solids comes from. Yeah, and it stayed harmonic. Absolutely, it was harmonic all the way through. The only thing that changed was the frequency of vibration. It stayed absolutely harmonic all through the development, and we got thermal expansion out of that. And it just comes from the fact that the frequencies depend on volume. In terms of, as far as terminology goes, the terminology that's used in the literature, what I went through is called the quasi-harmonic approximation. So the frequencies remain harmonic all the way through. They're only allowed to depend on volume, the frequencies are. If you were to take into account the full shape of the potential well, that's what's called anharmonic. And that's a very distinct thing. And there have been some people in the literature that have used those interchangeably and kind of sloppily, I think, unfortunately. But this quasi-harmonic approximation that I talked about, all the thermal effects just coming from the volume dependence of the frequencies, I think is consistent with all the data that we have. I mean, this is good enough for mantle materials. Yeah.
What are the nature of the interactions? How far do they go? How far do you get reliable results?
There are a couple of ways of answering that. Let's see. One way to think about it, in principle, there will be vibrational modes that extend over the entire length of the crystal. So they could be centimeters, even meters across. But those vibrational modes won't contribute very much to the thermal properties. So one way to think about it is to think about the smallest size of the unit cell, the periodically repeating unit that you can get away with and accurately compute thermodynamic properties. Now, if you Okay, so if you go to larger and larger unit cells, now multiples of the actual primitive unit cell of the material, as you go to larger and larger unit cells, the Brillouin zone gets folded back on itself. Every time that you double the unit cell, it gets folded once. And as you fold then, every time you fold, you derive new information about the phonon dispersion curves, and you send them back to the Brillouin zone center where you're actually doing your calculations, if you're doing an MD simulation, say. So the more foldings that you do, the more doublings of the unit cell that you do, the more information you get, until by the time you get to something as large as the quartz unit cell, you're doing fairly well. And one way to see how well you're doing, or to quantify how well you're doing, is to look at how flat these branches are. The extent to which they're flat will tell you how much of the thermal energy you're calculating just by doing a Brillouin zone center calculation on the supercell. So that's one way to think of it. So for perovskite, we use the movie I showed you comes from a unit cell that contains 80 atoms, which is four times larger than the primitive unit cell.
I guess the picture I had in mind was, if people talk about water and the funny behavior of water, where you get this thought the argument always was that these were long range rafters, not just short range. And I wondered whether or not these sort of same things were both.
Well, I mean, you certainly do have long-range interactions, and it's absolutely crucial to do calculations on an infinite periodically repeated system. If you had only an isolated 80 atom unit cell, with the surface effects would be overwhelming, and you wouldn't get anything sensible at all. Now, let's see. Liquids can be different. They have more complicated structures, of course, and sometimes you can have very long-range structure in the liquid, not as long-range in the crystal, not the translational periodicity. But some of the scales of structure can exceed the sort of 80 atom scale that I was talking about before for perovskite. They can be longer than the periodic repeat distance in the crystal. What do the edges do? Oh, in a real crystal of a real size, the edges do almost nothing, because there's so few atoms on the edge compared to the amount of atoms in the interior. With 10 to the 23rd atoms, maybe one part in 10 to the 18 or something are on the surface. And so they have almost no effect. Until you get down to crystals that are a nanometer, maybe 10 nanometers in size. And then all kinds of interesting things can happen, and this is the basis of much of the nanotechnology business, that you can transform insulators into metals, you can change structures, you can do all kinds of weird things once you get to nanometer-sized crystals. Yeah, the defects and dislocations, as far as we can tell from experimental measurements and so on, don't affect any of the properties that I talked about here. Their concentration is sufficiently small that things like thermal expansivity, bulk modulus, and so on aren't affected. Of course, they completely control something like viscosity or attenuation. And that's one of the things that's challenging about studying those, because you're talking about concentrations of maybe one part in 10 to the 8th or something, and they're completely controlling the property of interest, the transport property of interest. And we'll come back to that. But as far as we know, these sort of equilibrium properties aren't affected by them. Nor would small concentrations of water, for example, matter. That would be another. You could think of the small concentrations of water that might exist in the mantle as sort of a defect, and they would have, as far as we can tell, essentially no influence on any of this.